On the premiere episode of Piled High and Deep, we talk with a PhD who spent a year in high school in France, an undergraduate semester in China, all leading up to her graduate studies that focused on the rise of the working class in post-Soviet Poland.
I was really moved by solidarity, by the way it upheld a set of liberal values about freedom of speech and freedom of intellectual inquiry and social solidarity among people in the face of a government that was trying to crush them, actually. I mean, literally crush them.
An anthropologist tells us about her PhD journey and how she is now focusing on the millions of people forcibly displaced throughout the world, many of whom appear to be permanently part of the international humanitarian system. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by Mountain Geek Productions. Please check out our website at themountaingeek.net. This podcast also has a website of its own, phdthepodcast.com. Also, like us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at phdthepodcast. Now, let's start piling it high and deep. And welcome to the premiere episode of Piled High and Deep. I'm Ted Conti. Whenever you do something new, you reach out to your friends and ask for their help, and I've done just that. Dr. Elizabeth Dunn is an associate professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Indiana in Bloomington. She's a dear friend and is joining us live from her home.
Hi, it's good to be here. Thanks for letting me be the first guest.
Or the first victim. We'll see how the next hour goes. As I mentioned in the introductory podcast episode and also in the introduction to this episode, I'm fascinated by people that get their doctorates. A doctorate of philosophy. You spend so much time, somebody's spending so much time in a classroom, reading a lot of books, doing research. They have found a topic of study that is of such interest to them that they just can't let go of the bone. Think of my dog chewing on that Christmas bone after the big prime rib dinner that we had. His interest in that, not wanting to let go of that subject, that field, that interest level.
You know, I think it's true that you don't do this job unless you're super tenacious. It's not necessarily that you're more brilliant than the average person, but that you grab hold of an idea and you can't let it go, like a terrier with a tennis ball. So I think you'll find a lot of people are like that.
And isn't that the same thing, you know, with whether it's a musician or any type of a writer or an artist, they get something in themselves, in their blood, that they just can't let go of. And they take it to this, for them, natural, there's never really ever a conclusion, is there?
No, there's never a conclusion. You just sort of circle around the same set of ideas over and over, looking at them from different vantage points, understanding them differently as you yourself mature and your vantage point changes. And that's a life's work, right? But you're always kind of circling around the same core idea.
So let's start with that core idea. Right now, as an associate professor in the Department of Geography, tell me what you do.
Well, my research work right now is focused on refugees and displaced people. But what I'm really interested in is large systems of power. How is it that the systems that govern us, from the UN to big humanitarian agencies to big corporations, manage the way we behave by changing how we think about ourselves? That's my key issue.
Changing how we think about ourselves. Is that both as an individual item and then as a group think exercise?
I think that's in both senses. Like it's a personal identity, what you think about yourself and your ability to do things in the world. And it's also very much a collective identity. Who are you if you are a refugee? Who are you if you are a manager? Who are you if you're a shop floor worker? And so I think a lot of these big systems do an enormous amount of work to convince you of certain kinds of propositions about who you are in the world and what your capacity for action is.
All righty. That's a good pausing spot. Let's talk about how you got to this point in your life.
Sure.
You and I have known each other for a long time. You're my wife's bestest friend in the entire universe.
Since kindergarten.
So let's talk about where you started. I know that you grew up here at least a short time here in Denver.
I did. Most of the time, in fact.
Teachers. Yep.
Yeah.
What was kind of the attitude in growing up in your household? What level of importance was education put on you?
My parents were educators. So like school's job number one and everything else is secondary. And, you know, I was surprised much later to find out that in other households, like, sports were more important than school, because I couldn't imagine that. I mean, you were expected to go to school. If you weren't actually dead, you had to be in school. So that was really important. But what was really important in our house was ideas. And at dinner at my house, we would argue about genetics or politics, or we would talk about botany, because especially for my father, I think ideas are paramount. They're the way that you go through the world and engage with the world. So a lot of what we did at home was debating constantly, you know, is there a genetic basis for homosexuality? Will global warming change plant life? I mean, these are big topics to talk about with sixth graders, but that's what we talked about.
Your father has his PhD?
He has an EDD. He's a school administrator.
Alrighty. And your mother?
My mother is, she has a master's degree and some PhD work, but my mother is just a polymath. She's interested in everything.
What drove you? What were your interests in school, let's say leading up to high school? Let's talk about everything before high school. What were your favorite subjects?
Well, I'm a language person. So I've been a writer since, I think I wrote, we laugh about my first book. My first book was a murder mystery, but I wrote it, you know, in wide-ruled paper, I think with a crayon. So I've been a writer my whole life, and I'm a language person. So I really see what I did early in life, playing with language, trying to write poetry, doing school reports, as sort of my first practice forays into learning the skills that I use every day now. So I always thought of myself as sort of an English person. But then I became a social studies person, because I became really interested in what was over the other side of the hill. What was the rest of the world like that I couldn't see? And that became really an obsession for me from like sixth or seventh grade on.
When did foreign language start to interest you?
Oh, I was maybe 11. So I took a little French class that someone organized in their living room, and we learned the colors and we learned the numbers. And for me, this was like the opening of an entire world, right? I mean, I couldn't believe that you could speak a different language and people could understand you. And I think because I did language classes that were really focused on communication rather than on grammar, the notion that you could find out about somebody else's worldview, about somebody else's experience that's so different than yours by speaking their language, that was something that came to me really early. And that was really different than the people in my family. My mom had always been interested in foreign countries, but had never had a chance to travel. And my dad is somebody who has everything he wants and doesn't really feel the need to go anywhere else. So he's not that interested in traveling. So for me, that was something kind of different in my family, that I wanted to get out there and see the rest of the world.
When did you get that first experience?
In high school, there was one of these 6 weeks exchange programs. And, you know, they say it's going to be transformative for kids. And I think for most kids, it's probably not that transformative. But for me, it was just a revelation. So I went to France and, oh my God, everything was different. Things that I now see as, you know, whatever, not very different. The labels are in a different language. It was for me then just unbelievable. And I was collecting things like toothpaste tubes, because they had words on them that weren't in English. And I thought that was just astounding. So I did that for 6 weeks. And then the next year, I dropped out of high school and decided to move to France to be a nanny. So I got to live with a family for about 9 months in a little tiny village in France. And I think I was the first American there since the end of World War II. And that was like everyday life in another culture. That was the first time I got to experience another culture, not as a tourist, but as an insider. And that for me was just compelling, that there were these French peasants who swore at each other in a language I had never heard, which was Languedoc, an old language that never got absorbed into French. And that there was this other country with its other history, and that people were living lives that were radically different than the one I knew in Montana. For me, that was just absolutely compelling.
Okay, so let's back up here a little bit. You have parents that are educators. Your father is an administrator. Your mother's a school teacher. And they let you drop out of high school? How did that go over?
I don't think let was not the operative word there. I just did it. I think that, you know, it did not go over well. My father kept saying to me, but can't you just be normal? Can't you just go have a normal senior year of high school? And, you know, I've never had a really big drive to be normal. I think if you're going to be an anthropologist, you have to be a person who's quite comfortable being on the margins of your own society in order to be comfortable being on the margins of somebody else's society. So I didn't have any drive to be normal. I wanted to go out adventuring. And I'm lucky that they trusted me at a certain point and realized that I needed to do this. And they backed me up, even though they themselves were terrified by it.
So you took off, was this after your junior year?
After my junior year in high school. And my father tells the story of not getting the call from me that he thought he would get when I arrived in Paris. And because I couldn't figure out how the payphones worked. And just panicking. He says he was just clenched with fear, realizing that if something had happened to me, there was nothing he could do about it. And I think as a parent myself now, I think how brave that was of him, really.
To let you go.
To let me go. And to realize that I had to go, that there was something in my essential nature that made me need to leave and need to go out and see what was out there. That I think to recognize that your child is somehow very, very different from you and that there's something in them compelling them to do something that you would never do. I think that is in many ways the greatest challenge of parenting.
So let's go back. We can hit on that because I do want to talk just because I know your background and there's some great stories mm-hmm. moving forward in your academic life that brings in kids especially. But you've only mentioned your father in this. What happened to mom? What was her attitude about this? Was she a little envious?
Oh, my mom's attitude. Oh, yeah. My mom's attitude was that she had always wanted to do this and she was super supportive of my doing it. And I never could have done what I did in terms of having language lessons and being able to go on that first 6-week trip if my mom hadn't just really pushed for it, because it's what she had always wanted to do and never been able to do. And it wasn't too much longer after I started traveling that she started traveling farther and wider than I ever will. So she got her dream.
So you were very much the catalyst for her adventuring as well.
I think it made her braver. I think when she saw me doing it, she realized it was doable and started going herself.
Did you end up graduating with just a GED? Did you go back to high school? Were you a year late? What happened there?
Yeah, I went back to high school. I was short half a credit in like printmaking when I dropped out. So I went back, took a morning French class, called it good, and graduated. But, you know, by the end of my junior year in high school, I was out the door. Like, I was done with high school a good 2 years before I was supposed to be done with high school.
Was that as a result of you just weren't getting the brain stimulus that you needed?
Well, I think it was two things. I think one is that American high schools, I mean, it's a mass-produced education, right? I mean, it's a McDonald's education in the sense that it's supposed to be basically the same thing for everybody. And there's some flexibility. You can pick different classes. But our educational system does not do very well serving outliers on either end of the spectrum. So kids who are cognitively challenged and kids who are cognitively advanced are very poorly served by the American education system. So I was just bored, I think was part of it. But also that I dislike conformism and I dislike being told what to do. So I mean, there's my endless fascination right. with power and how it works. Like, I think that stems from a basic inclination, which says that you are not the boss of me.
Do you think that that's a common theme I'm going to hear in this amongst other PhDs?
No, not necessarily. I think people are driven by different problematics that almost always come out of their own lives. But I don't think that power is everybody's.
Well, maybe not necessarily the power thing, but the boredom issue.
Yeah, a certain kind of intellectual restlessness. Because this is not a career that rewards people who are intellectually passive. You have to be kind of self-driven or you're not going to survive all the way to a PhD.
Right.
So certainly not through tenure. And so it's a system that rewards people who are quite independent and who drive themselves, but that also means that they tend to be very bad about fitting into large organizational structures. So, you know, pity the dean that has to manage the faculty, because they're the most cantankerous, hard to manage group of people in the world.
Okay. Let's talk about your college decision. I know where you went. How'd you make that decision? What did you look at? Because having a child that just made that college decision, I certainly, and you know, you and I are the same age. Okay, you're a year younger than I am. But the choices that we had, or that we knew that we had when we were making that college decision, were much narrower than kids have today. And I think that that's just through a product of information.
Oh, I don't think that's true at all, actually. I would say the reverse, that now kids are more constrained than ever because of the expense. And so, you know, like I told my son, I said, you have two choices. You can go to Harvard or you can go to Front Range Community College, but those are the two options I can afford, right?
Right.
And so I was one of those people who benefited by the fact that private universities were growing large endowments. And that is now, you know, 100 times a bigger issue that today than it was then. But I wanted to go to Middlebury College and couldn't afford to go to Middlebury College. Got admitted to Middlebury College, couldn't go to Middlebury College. I was told by my high school guidance counselor that I was not a good, that there was zero likelihood that I could get to an Ivy League school, which was not true, actually. Thank you very much. I would have done just fine there. But so I applied to Middlebury, to Bryn Mawr. And they were all in a consortium then where they set financial aid together, and they wouldn't give me enough financial aid to go. And one of my backup schools was the University of Rochester, which, I mean, who the hell's ever heard of the University of Rochester, upstate New York? But my parents had gone there and my grandparents went there. So I was a legacy and I had really good grades and I was from the West, which was diversifying for them. And so they offered me enough money to go. And so that's where I ended up. And that ended up being, you know, a really unexpected, unpredictable gift, because I wandered then by accident, actually, into an anthropology department. I thought I wanted to be in political science. And I walked into an anthropology program that was just at that moment really desperate to grow its undergraduate program. And so what I ended up with was like six private tutors. And all of them took an enormous personal interest in me and what I was thinking. They let me make up my own classes. They teach whatever I wanted. They would say, you know, oh, get eight of your friends together and you can have a class in nationalism if you want it. And so I really ended up with a kind of bespoke education that you just cannot get anywhere anymore. It was pure accident and it was just absolute joy.
So that's one of the things in Piled High and Deep that I want to discuss and delve into is the importance of those outside forces, that those outside forces have on people to point you in the direction. Coming up later in this series, I'll be talking to my cousin David, who's a geneticist at USC, and he went to Stanford. He didn't know what the hell he wanted to do.
No, it's so accident. It's so much accident. My first year, my freshman year of college, Rochester had this program in the January term, a short 4-week term in January, where they'd bring in all these like stellar people from the world of arts and letters and music, and they would assign freshmen to shepherd them around. And I got assigned to host Ursula K. Le Guin. And so my job was to pick her up at one event and take her to the next event. But that meant I got to talk to her a lot for days while we were walking around campus. And at one point she asked me, she said, well, what's your major? Which is what you'd ask a freshman. And I said, well, I don't know. I thought I was going into political science, but I just took this amazing anthropology course. I had no idea, right? But Ursula K. Le Guin's father was Alfred Kroeber. He's the founder of American anthropology, really. And she's a very intense person. And she grabbed my arm, grabbed me by the wrist, actually, and stared at me with this intense stare and said, "The world has too many lawyers and not enough anthropologists. Go be an anthropologist." And by God, it was like I had been given permission not to do what I wanted. It was like I had been given permission to be who I was. And that was absolutely liberating.
Have you ever followed up with her on that? Have you ever have you reached out to her since then?
Yes. I once sent her a note about, I think I sent her a note as I was finishing my PhD saying, "Hey, I just wanted you to know you changed my life. Thank you." And she wrote me back and said, "I rarely respond to people's letters, but in yours, I'll respond by telling you how happy I am for you. Thank you. You know, I'm glad you're an anthropologist."
Oh, that's neat. That's neat.
Yeah.
So you had that one defining moment. And then you talked about having six tutors in the department there. What were the other roadmaps that you were given by that department?
What was beautiful is I wasn't given a roadmap. I was sort of, they would stand and open doors for me. "Are you interested in this? What do you think of that? Do you like that?" And they would pass along opportunities to me. And one of them was this NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the soon-to-be departed National Endowment for the Humanities.
No, we're not going to say those. No, we're going to think
I hope not. Jesus. But, you know, they had a program which must have cost them nothing. I mean, almost nothing. But it was a program where they would give undergraduates a little bit of money in the summer and let them do their own research. And my advisors passed that along to me, and I had just come back from China, and because I did my junior year abroad in Beijing under martial law, actually. And this NEH fellowship gave me the summer to write a thesis and then to go present it at a national conference for undergraduate research at Caltech. And that was, I mean, now I look back at it and I think how ridiculous it was to have these little, 19-year-olds presenting their research. But it was great. It was my first foray into what being an academic would be like. And I was absolutely hooked. And I think now, I think they gave me $2,000. What a cheap program that was, and how much it did to encourage people to go into the humanities and the social sciences.
Let's talk a little bit more about your college, that undergrad college experience. You mentioned Sure. you spent a semester studying abroad in Beijing.
I did.
You were there during the Tiananmen Square uprising.
Just after, actually.
Okay. So how do you did that your first or second semester of your junior year?
My second semester of my junior year.
Alrighty.
So the Tiananmen Square massacre was in June and I arrived there in January.
Oh, okay. Alrighty. So how do you go, how does that process for you, how does that work academically? And how did that lead you down the road? What was the intent that you put in front of you to go to Beijing? Or was it just, did you kind of look at it like, "Oh, hey, I've been to France. That was really cool. Let's go see something completely opposite."
No, not at all. I mean, I sort of stumbled into Chinese because I thought that French was easy and I wanted something hard. And indeed, it was backbreakingly hard. But I got interested in China also because I became interested in authoritarianism and authoritarian governments. And so once the Tiananmen Square massacre happened, I actually wanted to go to China more, not less, because I wanted to know what it was like to live under a government that was squashing political expression to that degree. And so I marched in with a project on democracy and the speeches of Mao Zedong. I mean, it's amazing I didn't get me and everybody around me arrested. Because I was asking really inconvenient political questions, scary political questions. In those days, the campus at Beijing University was under really severe surveillance. The entire freshman class had been bundled off and sent to a labor camp. And the remaining students, that's where the heart of the Tiananmen Square movement had been. So the remaining students were under enormous political pressure. And I sort of stumbled in like a moron asking inconvenient questions. But it really taught me a lot about what it's like to live under a government that is overtly repressive. And that really sparked my interest in communism as a system and trying to understand what the transition away from communism around the world would be like in the post-socialist world.
You graduate?
I did indeed graduate.
And what was, did you do a separate master's program at another university? What was that? What was that next step?
I did. After I finished at Rochester, I went off to the University of Chicago, which was then the number one program in anthropology in the country. I think it's still maybe or number two. And boy, that was a big dose of cold water because I left college thinking I was the smartest thing that had ever lived. And I got to the University of Chicago and they were very clear that I was an idiot. They were very clear that all of us in my entering class were idiots. But I was particularly an idiot because I had been only schooled in one kind of anthropology. I didn't know there were other kinds. And they were then very interested in a very philosophical anthropology. The first class I took was from a very famous anthropologist named Marshall Sahlins, who's also, I have to say, not a very nice person. And he was brutal. I mean, it was 99 books in 9 weeks, starting at Montesquieu and going all the way to Marx. No, that's not true. We started at Herodotus, starting at Herodotus and ending up 9 weeks later at Marx. So if you can imagine in a week trying to read, you know, Spinoza, but then on top of that, also having Vico, Pico, Pirandello, I mean, it was meant to be overwhelming. It was meant really as a power move to show you how little you knew and how tiny you were and how big the world of knowledge was. And it was meant to be intimidating. And I was intimidated.
Do you like it?
I was
miserable. You were miserable.
No, I hated it.
Was it?
Absolutely okay. Miserable.
How did you survive then that first year of graduate school?
Well, I almost didn't. My first day of graduate school, I had a cerebrovascular accident. My brain shorted out and I spent most of my first year of graduate school really, really sick. And I think that that did not improve matters. But I also had come out of an environment which was extremely encouraging and nurturing and into an environment in which the belief was that they were going to break you down in order to build you back up. And I watched a lot of people get broken down and not built back up, just left broken. You know, at the University of Chicago in those years, they had a 95% attrition rate. 95% of the people who entered would not complete the PhD. And they saw this as a kind of survival of the fittest. But I don't think it was. It was in many ways a survival of the most conformist or a survival of the people who could echo their own beliefs and attitudes back to them. And it certainly was an environment in which you were encouraged to let everything else drop except this intellectual project. So people didn't exercise. People didn't shower. People didn't have hobbies or friends. I'm not sure that they had sex. I mean, it was really all consuming. And I don't think that that was healthy or good. And so after my second year, I left.
Had you finished? So was the intent then to undergrad straight to PhD? There wasn't kind of a middle ground that you were going to do the master's thing?
Well, I didn't. Yeah, no, there's no point. A terminal, you know, here's what you can do with a terminal master's in anthropology, you know, deliver pizza.
Right. Okay.
That's the joke. How do you get the anthropologist off your doorstep? Pay for the pizza. But I think that it was the decision to leave was a very challenging one for me, right? The decision to say, I hate this. I'm out of here. Look, when I got sick, the first thing they thought that was happening to me is that I had meningitis, and so they or viral encephalitis. So they inserted a hep lock into my arm, which is a port directly into your vein, and they were pumping me full of antivirals, trying to get enough antiviral medication into my body that it would go up to my brain. And I was so scared of failing that I would remove my own IV from the hep lock, wrap my arm in a bandage, scurry across the street, go to class. 3 hours later, sneak back into the hospital, unwrap my arm, and reinsert my own IV line. Like, that's insane. But that's the level of panic I had, that if I missed a day, if I missed a class, that I would be out forever. And I think that that's a kind of pressure that some people really thrive on. I was not one of them. I think it's really destructive to treat people that way.
The attitude of that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger?
No, it's the attitude of that which doesn't kill you doesn't kill you. And then they'll see who emerges at the back end of it, you know, through this kind of torture zone. But looking back on it, I still don't see any reason for that kind of approach. I think that you can put people through an intellectually intense experience in a way that is joyful and positive and supportive, rather than being just sort of soul crushing.
Is that what you found at Johns Hopkins?
Yeah. So I moved to Johns Hopkins, and I actually moved because I had gone back to Rochester to hear their famous Morgan lecture series. And the Morgan lecturer, the first year after I graduated from Rochester, was being done by Catherine Verdery, who was a professor at Johns Hopkins who was working in post-socialist Romania. And she was really one of the only anthropologists who had worked behind the Iron Curtain. So she was talking about what the end of socialism meant, or how socialism itself worked, and how that would shape what came next. And so I spent 2 weeks driving her around. This is how big things happen in my life, when I just take big people around for no reason. But I spent 2 weeks chauffeuring her around. And by the end of that 2 weeks, we had decided that I would leave and come work with her. And that was topical, right? Because she worked on something that I wanted to work on, and nobody at Chicago was working on it. But it happily also ended up bringing me into this incredibly intense, vibrant community of people who found themselves stronger and smarter together than alone and in isolation. And at Chicago, there had been this monastic ideal that you should go into a room alone, think great thoughts for 8 years, and emerge with this big book, your famous dissertation, which would be the biggest thing that ever lived. And at Hopkins, we believe that ideas happened when we were in community, that good thinking happened in community. And it is true that in those years, the people who were there became some of the most famous people in academia and beyond. In fact, one of them was one of my first teachers at Hopkins, a professor named Ashraf Ghani. And Ashraf later left academia, went to the World Bank, and is today the president of Afghanistan. So, he's enacting the ideas and the perspective that we developed there at Hopkins. So it's at Hopkins that I learned the intense synergy of brilliant people being in community together. And that was thanks to a man named Sidney Mintz, who probably is one of the most brilliant scholars of food in the world, started food studies as an academic discipline.
So that moves into your focus of research. How did you get to that point of, the title of it is Privatization and Personhood, Transforming Work in Post-Socialist Poland. What led up to that decision as to what you would study? Where did that light bulb come?
Yeah, I knew it about a month into graduate school. When I got back from China, China in those years was grim and cold and depressing and oppressive. I mean, any stereotype you have about the gray concrete nature of communism that was Beijing in 1990, right? It was the last gasp of straight on Stalinism. So I came back and I had, I think, amazing reverse culture shock. I mean, really strong reverse culture shock. I melted down in a grocery store my first night home. It was so bright. There were so many colors. Everything was yelling at me. And but I had lived through 6 months of incipient violence. And even if you didn't see people getting shot in the street, you were aware all the time that there were armed guards all around you, that the city was full of 70,000 soldiers, and you knew you could be shot or run over by a tank at any moment. You knew that clashes between demonstrators and the government could happen at any moment. So I came home with what I would say now is some pretty raging PTSD. And my advisor at Rochester, Tony Carter, said, you know, you need some hope. Why don't you go study a social movement that actually succeeded? Here, go study solidarity in Poland and don't come back. And indeed, I didn't come back. I was really moved by solidarity, by the way it upheld a set of liberal values about freedom of speech and freedom of intellectual inquiry and social solidarity among people in the face of a government that was trying to crush them, actually. I mean, literally crush them. And so for me, it was an enormously hopeful tale that the people coming together could, in fact, overturn an unjust government. So then the question was, I mean, solidarity won, right? Communism ends in 1989. So it's 1991, and I'm looking at the aftermath, and I'm thinking, wow, whatever happened to those workers? Everybody's talking about the intellectual wing of solidarity. They're running the government now. But what happened to the shop floor workers who were really the backbone of this movement? And so I had decided that for my graduate work, I would go to a factory where the workers had been part of solidarity, and I would try and understand what post-socialism meant for them. So I ended up in Poland, and I was at first supposed to work in a car factory. So I had in Baltimore, while I was still in Baltimore, I had learned to spot weld. I had worked in a GM factory on Browning Highway, learning to like do basic auto assembly. But when I got to Poland, FSO, the factory I was going to work at, was taken over by Daewoo, a Korean company. So I got thrown out. And I was sort of wandering the streets of Warsaw in the rain. You know, my life was over. My dissertation was dead. What was I going to do? And I met up with this professor. This guy had been like an old communist, like a really ideologically committed communist. And he says, Ella, let's go. Let's drink on this. So we knock back a couple of vodkas in his office, like high test vodka warm. And nothing occurred to us. So he said, well, Ella, let's go drink out on this. So we went off to a bar and we're drinking warm vodka. And in stumbles this other sociologist. And he says, oh, well, I have a friend who's the director of human resources at the new Gerber baby food plant. Why don't you go down there? And so I, you know, a week later, I was in Rzeszów, Poland, which is the middle of bloody nowhere, working in what had been a communist fruit and vegetable factory, which became a Gerber baby food plant. You know, like it's never what you expect.
That takes a few minutes for your brain to wrap around. But given what's happened in the last 25, 30 years, as we've seen American companies roll through and become these huge multinational corporations, it makes sense that Gerber has to make baby food. They're not going to ship the baby food that they make here in the United States to Poland. So they might, you know, it's a well-known brand, might as well make it over there.
And that was really, that was an interesting time because it was the first years of neoliberalism, you know, a kind of globalized corporation run political economic order, which I'm afraid now is, you know, dying quickly. But I got in on the ground floor of this, the globalization of neoliberal corporate management. And so that was what I became interested in. Like, what are the basic ideas of neoliberal economics and how do we see them from a post-socialist point of view?
How did those experiences then lead you to the dissertation? What was that? You know, it's not like with, you know, if somebody's getting their PhD in a hard science, they're in a lab, they're crunching numbers, they're using that data to put together their dissertation, prove their theory, disprove their theory, make their changes. What were your steps? What did you do to get to this dissertation?
Well, you know, anthropologists use a research method called ethnography, which is basically to go live as the people that you're studying and try and understand the world from their point of view. So I always joke that my initial research question was, Poland, what's up with that? but actually, it was maybe a little more well-formulated, but it was really about how is it that a change a macro level change in an economic system changes people's view of themselves as human beings in the world. And it turned out that American corporations were very much interested in transforming people from what they saw as sort of hopelessly backward Homo Sovieticus and making them instead into what they saw as the fit subjects of a neoliberal corporation. So the idea that your labor belongs to you and that you can sell it, or that you are your own product and so you have to have your own brand and you have to be constantly upgrading your own quality so that your labor is worth more. Those were like ideas that we now see as sort of normal, that we're all entrepreneurs of ourselves. Those ideas were brand new in Poland in 1991. No one had ever thought like that before. So I watched the corporation trying to teach people to think of themselves that way, as alienable labor that could be improved in its quality and that could be scientifically evaluated in its quality and compensated according to its quality. Those were all completely new ideas in Poland, and they overturned some of the big ideas behind solidarity, like we all have the same stomach, or people have equal rights to make demands from the government for care, no matter what they do as a job, right? That the lowest factory worker and the most important manager all have equal rights to help from the government. Those ideas were very quickly being dismissed as old and socialist and worthless. And a new idea which supported fundamental social inequality was coming in. And I think factory workers were very much resisting that idea. They didn't believe that the reason that they were making less money and having less social power all of a sudden was because they were less worthwhile as human beings. They didn't subscribe to that notion, but that was the notion that was coming out, right? That if somebody else made more money than you and had more power than you, it's because they were better, more worthwhile human beings than you.
How long did you spend in Poland?
Oh my God, off and on, probably 3 years.
Working at that same factory or?
Yeah, I would come back. I worked in the factory for a solid year, and then I came back to Baltimore for a while, and then I went back to the factory for 6 months. And, you know, anthropologists will tend to do that. They'll do a big chunk of fieldwork and then dip in and out over the summers while they can. And I, as I was doing that, I was writing the dissertation.
What was So from the dissertation, what was that process for you? Was it onerous, arduous? Did you enjoy the writing part of it? You had said earlier you wrote your first book with crayons and a Big Chief pad.
Yeah. I think it was a Big Chief pad.
What was the dissertation process for you? Because by that time you had already said you'd written, you know, towards the end of your undergraduate degree, you had already fallen in love with the academic writing process. Had you been published in between those periods?
Yeah. I'd had a couple of articles come out, but the dissertation for me was an interesting process. I'd written about half of it, maybe a little less than half, when my advisor called and she said, all the senior faculty got into a giant fight with the dean and we all quit. So if you don't defend by the end of April, whatever the date was, there will be no one here to defend to. And I wasn't planning on defending that early. I had 6 weeks to write the rest of my dissertation. So I started writing, I mean, Jesus, just as fast as I could humanly write, right? I'm writing around the clock. And at one point, I had to hire a dog walker to come in and walk my dog, because I was sleeping in like 5 hour berth. I just didn't have time. I mean, it looked like my apartment had been broken into. When I finally came to, like, I mean, you know, I photocopied the dissertation when it was done. I was just staggering. I hadn't slept through the night in maybe 6 weeks. And I put the dissertation in at Kinko's to be copied and staggered over to a Dunkin' Donuts. And I was there before the first donuts came out. And had to wait for the man to bring the donuts at like 4:30 in the morning, turn in my dissertation. And when I come home, it looks like someone has broken into my house and just tossed the place. And I start like turning the furniture back upright and starting to dig. And the cat has been killing mice and just leaving their little corpses on the floor. And they had desiccated. So there were all these like dried mice all over the floor in my apartment. And I remember thinking, God, my back was just locked up from sitting over that computer so long. And I put on one shoe to go for a walk. Like, I'll go for a walk. Put on one shoe. Passed out cold. Woke up 17 hours later with one shoe on. So it was like this enormous burst where I didn't do anything but that until it was finished. Which can be a real high, right? To write like that. To put everything else away and just focus on that can be a real intellectual, emotional high, but it really exerts a cost. It drains you like nothing else in the world.
PhD, what was the defense like?
Oh, it was hilarious, actually, because, at that point, it was just, no PhD candidate ever realizes this, but there are basically no contested defenses. If you're not going to pass, they won't let you walk into the room.
Okay.
So you might get sent back to do some revisions and stuff, but you're going to pass. If they're letting you in, you're going to pass. So I show up and I'm wearing a white suit because it's spring and I thought I should get a suit to show up for my defense. So I'm in a white suit and they ask me questions. And at one point I couldn't answer it. I don't know. My brain just froze. And one of the committee members says, here, let me tell you, it's on page 34, So they really shepherded me through it and they knew I was going to pass and because they were quitting, right? They were leaving. And so I went back to my office. They sent me out of the room to deliberate. I went back to my office, which was right near the seminar room. And all of a sudden they start walking out, right? They're walking out. And finally I look at my advisor and I'm like, well, and she's like, oh yeah. Congratulations, Dr. Dunn. That was it. It was kind of a letdown. And so then I'm standing there in the department and she goes out and she comes back and she looks at me and she says, I have a flat tire. I'm there in a white suit. And she's looking at me like I'm supposed to do something about this, right? I have a flat tire. And I looked at her and I said, and I have a PhD. And that was the end of that. She made some other scrub go change her tire.
Right. Okay. What was... for you, how momentous was the walking ceremony? Was that?
Mine wasn't for a year later. I flew back for it a year later, but at that point it was sort of,
meh.
Yeah, not much.
Okay.
So, yeah. And I've been through 29 of them since then. So I think the bloom is off that rose.
Right. Okay. So, what's your first gig after you have your piled high and deep behind your name?
So I went off to do a postdoc at the Wissenschaftskolleg in Berlin, which is the Institute for Advanced Study there. And that was quite an amazing experience. I got to hang out with people who had Nobel Prizes. One of the rules was that you had to show up for lunch every day. And so I grabbed my lunch tray and you sit down at the next available seat. Like you're supposed to mix it up every day. So I sit down with two guys I don't know, because people are always coming in and out of the Institute. And I realize as they start talking that one of them is Amos Oz, the incredibly well-known Israeli writer. And the other one is Kenzaburo Oe, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature. And they had corresponded with each other in public, these open letters to each other over the course of many years, mostly about nuclear warfare. And because Oe writes about Hiroshima, the after effects of Hiroshima. And they had corresponded for years, but had never met in person. So I sat down for lunch and watched them meet in person. It was just astounding. I mean, just amazing people that were coming through that place. And I think I didn't realize enough that my job was to sit down and shut up and listen. I think when you're young, you never realize how much you really should shut up. But I was incredibly honored and privileged to have been there that year.
So what was that postdoc year? What did you do other than sit down, talk a little more than you should have?
Talked a little more than I should have. Listen to people who are really, really very, very smart. I mostly worked on turning the dissertation into the book, which is meant that everything I had done in that 6-week binge basically got thrown out.
Right.
And I tried to rewrite the rest of the book as a readable book, not nearly so jargony. And I made some choices about the writing of that book that ended up being kind of strangely controversial. As opposed to the dissertation, the book, I simplified the language on a lot. And because I wanted to interact with political scientists and I wanted to interact with economists, and they had really been driving the debate over the transformation of Eastern Europe in the 90s. And they'd been driving it ideologically and they'd been driving it theoretically. Like, here's how a perfect market should work. We should get out of the way of the market. And I wanted to introduce some discussion of the human costs of letting the market be the most important thing. And I knew that if I wrote in anthropology jargon, that the book would never get read. And right. So I wrote it in a very deliberately not very jargony way. And that ended up being controversial because it meant that the book got read a lot, like 11,000 copies were sold eventually. It's in its third reprint now, two editions of which are in Polish. It stayed in print for 13 years, which is a really long time. And but inside anthropology, because it was written in that kind of language, it was seen as not very serious. It was not a very serious book. And in fact, at one point I went and interviewed for a job at Columbia University, and the guy interviewing me said, well, he said, half of us like your work and half of us find it overly accessible. And like, you know, whatever, that's fine. I'll own that. Yeah, I'm overly accessible, by which you mean too simplistic for you. But I think that has made me different as an academic, that I have this fundamental drive to reach out beyond the bounds of my own discipline and beyond the bounds of the academy to talk to people and to listen to people who don't often get their voices heard inside the academy.
Do you think that that's forgotten in academia and maybe why people don't feel that you use the term accessible? Do you think that people are overwhelmed by the idea of going down the PhD route because of those types of attitudes?
No, I think that the reason people don't get PhDs now is because we don't have enough support for graduate students and we don't have jobs for them when they finish. I mean, the neoliberal gutting of the university system has now been going on for 25 years. And when I was at University of Colorado, I watched its funding, its annual budget got cut by more than 60% during the 14 years I was there. You know, I mean, that's more, the budget was less than half of what it was in real dollars when I started. And when that happens, you're just not hiring faculty. You're hiring transient adjunct faculty. You're not supporting graduate students. You're not supporting a vibrant intellectual life. If universities are going to be something more than just vocational schools, and I think they should be, then we have to finance them. And I think the people who are opposed politically to the university system have discovered they don't have to fight the culture wars. They just have to cut off the money.
So let's talk about that next portion of your journey. It sounds like you had made the decision as an undergrad that you were going to go down that PhD route. Did you always have the idea that you would be in academia?
Yeah, always.
Was that always?
Yeah, always. Always, okay. From my second year of college onwards, yeah. And it's, you know, and it's a really good life. I it's a decision I'm glad I
right.
made.
But at what point, so you do your postdoc, then you come to Colorado, my alma mater.
Yeah.
I just got to get that in. At what point do you maintain your happy attitude about I'm living my dream?
Oh, the bloom was off that rose pretty fast because Colorado, like right after I got there in 2000, the university system came under enormous pressures because of the way that Colorado funds higher education. The budget ratchets down. Anytime the state budget goes down, the university's budget goes down. And then if the state's budget comes back up, the university's budget is frozen. So all of a sudden, you know, I had this dream that I would be teaching the way I was taught, like these small seminars of 15 people. You know, my first class was 485 kids. And when you're teaching a class of 485, you're not teaching, you're the mayor. You know, you're not trying to change people's intellectual lives. You're trying to get a bunch of grumpy out-of-state students who are pissed they have to take this remedial class out the door. And that, for me, really sucked a lot of the joy out of the academic life. And the other thing that happened in Colorado was that there was very little money for things like speakers and events and talks. And that's, for me, where I get my juice. You know, I try and go to a talk or two talks a week. And when there just weren't talks, that was a real intellectual impoverishment for me. I really was very sad and missed those a lot. So all of a sudden, I was extremely intellectually isolated. My department was doing very different things than I did. And I was teaching in a way I didn't want to teach. And academia became a kind of factory work. And I hadn't signed up to do factory work. I was signed up to avoid factory work. I knew what factory work was, actually, having worked in a factory. And I didn't want to do that. So that was a bad space for me to be in intellectually. And I really got stuck in a way that I wish I had left sooner.
Your first book, based on your dissertation, came out in 2004. You wrote again about Poland. Did you write again about Poland, or did you then focus on Georgia after that?
No. I wrote about Poland for another, I don't know, couple of years. But then I got this weird flaky chance to go to Georgia. And it happened because Sid Mintz, who was the founder of the Department at Hopkins and the founder of food anthropology, his son, Eric Mintz, was the director of the Department of Foodborne and Diarrheal Disease at the Centers for Disease Control, which I have always thought was kind of Freudian, actually. But Eric called Sid and said, hey, we're doing a project on hyperendemic botulism in the Republic of Georgia. We need someone who knows both post-socialism and canning. And Sid said, well, there's really only one person like that. And off I went to the Republic of Georgia, which I had frankly never heard of before. Maybe in passing, Stalin is from Georgia. But I knew nothing about the place. I don't think anybody knew very much about it in those years. That was 2002. It had just opened up after 25 years of state collapse, or 15 years of state collapse. And it was really rough. I mean, no functioning power grid, half the country taken over by warlords, real hardship and poverty. They had lived through two civil wars. And all of a sudden, there I was. And oh my God, it was just a fascinating country. Like, absolutely fascinating. All of the issues that had sort of been shut down in Poland by neoliberalism were still alive and out there in Georgia, because it had never been the target of so much corporate investment. So the question about who controls the state, will it be a democratic system? What is the role of ethnicity in this system? How do people separate themselves by ethnic identity? All of those questions were very live in Georgia. And it's a terrible, terrible place, and yet utterly beautiful and incredibly compelling. And I was just in love. I was gone. I was leaving Poland forever. So I spent the next few years trying to get a Fulbright to go back to Georgia, and finally landed a Fulbright for 2008. And so I came to Indiana University to learn Georgian. It was the only place in the country where they taught Georgian. We teach 37 languages here on campus. You can learn any language you want. So I came to Bloomington actually to learn Georgian. And the last day of my language class, I mean, I had rented my house. My kid and I were in suitcases. We're heading for the airport when the phone rings. And it's the State Department saying, don't get on the plane. The Russians have invaded. They bombed the airport. And, you know, Jesus Christ, what do you do? I sat in a hotel for 2 weeks trying to figure out which way to move and watching the war happen. And the war was over quickly because the Georgians got decimated really fast. But that war that experience of that war changed everything for me.
So it moved from being the growth of a food industry in Georgia to now looking at all these people that you'd made human connections with and trying to understand the impact that this war had turned them into forcibly displaced persons.
Yeah, yeah. All the farmers I knew that I had been planning on working with on a project about agriculture and food systems in Georgia had been ethnically cleansed. They had been bombed out of their house by the Russian 58th Army. And their houses were bombed, and then their houses were looted. The roofs ripped off, the pipes pulled out, the wiring ripped out of the walls to sell for scrap. And then when those houses were stripped bare, they were burned. And in a lot of cases, they were bulldozed, so people could never come back again. And the people I knew had been thrown into the international humanitarian system. They were what's called internally displaced people, IDPs, and had become persons of interest to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. So all of a sudden, where I thought I was an anthropologist of food and food systems, I became a specialist in forced migration. And so I spent, it was the most back-asswards scientific inquiry ever, I must say, because first I did the field work, then I read the literature, which hadn't been even written until I got back. And then I developed a question and wrote a book. So that's not the way you usually do it. But I spent my year in Georgia trying to understand what it meant for them to be part of the international humanitarian system.
Like you had said, you'd never even heard it. You'd never heard of Georgia other than the fact that it's one of the 50 states in our own union. But no. Georgia, the former Soviet Republic, part of the Soviet Union. You've been there. You spent at least 1 year there, and you've been back and forth since.
Yeah. Yeah, I've probably been there a total, grand total, everything put together now, something like 40 months.
Mm-hmm.
So
You dragged your kid there.
I dragged my kid there. Yeah, he spoke good Georgian for a while.
It wouldn't take much to get him back on that either, I'm sure.
I hope not.
As a result, you started writing about Georgia in 2008. Now you've got your next book, your second book coming out.
Yep.
Tell us about that.
So the new book, which is called Permanently Temporary, is about life in the humanitarian condition. And it's about really what it means to be in a camp and to be dependent on humanitarian aid from the international system and from the government of Georgia. And it's interesting that when I wrote it, IDPs and displaced people were not an issue on most people's radar, even though the number of them was going up and up and up. But in 2000,
the reality of it is that America, we didn't, as an American society, we didn't hear about these issues until the 90s when we heard
2015
until we, well, even Rwanda, even those issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
We really had no sense of people. What do you mean people live in camps their whole lives?
I think most Americans assume that if you go in a refugee camp, it's for 3 months or 6 months and then you go home or you
right.
get resettled. And what people didn't realize is that the average length of stay in a camp now is 17 years. Some of the people, there are actually two waves of displaced people in Georgia. Some of them were displaced in 1993 and lived in old Soviet hotels. And they're still displaced. They're still living in old Soviet hotels from 1993 onwards. So the fact that this is not a temporary condition, but a way of life, the fact that it's something more than emergency humanitarian aid can address, that's not an issue that became sort of common knowledge until 2015, really. So in that sense, I think my book may be too late to the party. That worries me. But it's also about what happens to people who are stuck in this condition of being unable to go home and unable to settle where they are. They're just constantly, permanently temporary. And that's a horrible way to live. It's a disabling way to live. It's no life at all.
And it speaks to millions that are not just in Georgia, but what we're seeing in the Middle East.
65.6 million people. And that's a population larger than the population of France. There is an entire nation of the nationless now. And that, I think, poses a set of political problems for us that we're trying to just ignore. And so when we think about the recent immigration ban that Trump has put forward, the object is to keep these people offshore in the hopes that you can forget that they're there. And you can't. And because when you hold people in this condition of being permanently temporary, you also open the door to their radicalization, to their, they're disempowered. They understand why they're disempowered. They understand that they are not welcome. They certainly feel their stigmatization as potential terrorists. As Hannah Arendt, the very famous German philosopher, once said, once they lost their homes, they were homeless. Once they lost their rights, they were rightless. Once they lost their states, they were stateless, the scum of the earth. And that's how people feel that they're being treated right now. That is an absolute hotbed for radicalization.
You point in that specifically in your book, in talking about the brothers that perpetrated the Boston Marathon bombing.
That's not in this book. That's in another set of articles. But I did do some work interviewing the family and friends and the community of origin of the Tsarnaev brothers. And they were also displaced people, right? Their family was displaced from Chechnya in 1944. They were deported by Stalin and sent to Kyrgyzstan. And then these boys were born in Kyrgyzstan as part of a stigmatized community of displaced people, and then themselves displaced again multiple times. And I think that permanent sense of anger, of being permanently outsidered, permanently marginalized, permanently stigmatized, yeah, they were angry. And I think while no one would ever justify the way they chose to deal with their anger, I think their anger is very much understandable.
Absolutely. Where do you go next? So you've got this book. It releases in April.
Yeah.
It
does.
Where are you going next with your work?
Two things. One is a scholarly. I'm starting a big project on refugees in the city. And I'm really interested in the ways that different kinds of urban infrastructures, different kinds of urban arrangements shape the way that refugees and displaced people are integrated into urban life. So we're hoping to work in Germany and in Turkey on that project, maybe also in Tbilisi in Georgia. And then my baby right now is that I am trying to open a Center for Refugee Studies at Indiana University. It'll be the first one in the United States. There's one at Oxford and there's one in Canada, but we don't have one in the US. And I think that that's going to be really important, both in terms of the scholarship on displaced people, but also in terms of being a center where we can be thought leaders about policy, about the involvement of private foundations and corporations in providing aid to displaced people, about social reintegration for displaced people in the United States. So I'm really hoping that this center is opened. And I am also very honored that I will be soon named to the board of Exodus Refugee Immigration, which is our local resettlement agency here in Indiana.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
If 25-year-old Elizabeth Dunn working in a baby food factory in Poland knew what your old Elizabeth Dunn was doing in 2017, what would she think?
She'd think it was going to be an awesome ride. Awesome ride. I have gotten to have more adventure, more fun, see more of the world, explore more, become deeply involved with people who are profoundly unlike me. I think it has been the most amazing ride on earth, and I'm so glad that I got to take it.
What do you tell students who you either see yourself in or express to you an interest in expanding their academic goals and maybe follow down a path like you?
Well, I tell them, don't do it if you're looking for fame and fortune. Don't do it if you think you can save the world, because you can't save the world this way either. Right. This is not a good way to save the world. But do it if you have an idea you can't let go of. If you really think that if you had to do a job in a bank and you'd come home and read this stuff anyway, then you should go to graduate school. If you think that you'd rather come home and watch Game of Thrones, then probably this is not the right field for you. This is the place you come when you're obsessed with an idea and you can't let it go.
Are you surprised in yourself that your obsession in the idea changed, or did it really change? Because as you had mentioned earlier, you've always been a fight the power girl.
I don't think it's really changed. It takes different colors and different forms, but this question about how you respond to what you see as illegitimate state power, that's the question of my life. That's the question I keep coming back to. And, you know, thank God for the Trump administration, which is giving me lots of new opportunities to explore this question. But yeah, you know, what does it mean to resist? What does it mean to fight a system which is coming down from above you? That's the question I focus on, and I have not let that question go.
What's the long term? You're looking to open the Center for Refugee Studies, the first in the United States. Is that kind of what the next, what you view your next 20 years as being a focus on? Is this it for, I mean, is this what you've glommed on to?
Well, I mean, the one thing I know is that whatever you think you're going to do something else.
Well, right.
But, you know, wars have a way of kind of blowing up your life and changing your direction. When I was at Johns Hopkins, the one thing I learned from Sid Mintz and Catherine Verdery and Ashraf Ghani is that you get to a position in your life where you have the ability to be intellectually generous to other people, to facilitate other people's thinking, to appreciate what they're doing, to make their work more possible. And I think that that's a great gift that we give each other as thinkers. And I'm really lucky. I mean, look, there are not very, very many people who get tenure track jobs. I mean, there's not very many people admitted to PhD programs. Of those, not many get tenure track jobs. Of those, you know, not all of whom get tenure, and certainly not all of whom are promoted to full professor, and I'm about to be promoted next year. And that means that I am extraordinarily privileged. I have a lot of freedom, and I have, frankly, increasingly a lot of power. And that lets me be generous in that way, that I can facilitate other people's important and meaningful work. And that's what I would really like to do, because I think that that's a kind of amplification of my own work. The more people I can get on board in this bigger project, the more my own work is being amplified. And that's important to me.
Elizabeth Dunn, thank you for joining me for our first episode of Piled High and Deep.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you again to Dr. Elizabeth Dunn. Her new book, Permanently Temporary, Forced Migration and Humanitarianism in the Republic of Georgia, comes out April 3rd. You can check out our website for a link and more information. I would like to thank the fine folks at Zencastr for the nifty web application that allows me to record podcast guests remotely, along with the help of a USB microphone. And while you're listening to my voice, and this may be my podcast, it cannot get done without a help of a village, and I have my village. First of all, thanks to my wife, Meg Brennan. She's put up with me as I search for an outlet for my radio addiction that I've been controlling for, oh, come about the last 20 years. But it's ready to emerge. That's why I've got a podcast. Also, thanks to Dave Neal at Wham Bam Music. You'll be hearing some of his music in upcoming episodes. Dave has also helped me out because razor blades and splicing tape just don't work on computers. Also, thanks to Sean Reza for my great Piled High and Deep logo. The plan for Piled High and Deep is to make this a weekly podcast. So please come and check us out next week, or even better, subscribe to us. That way you'll get an automatic download. Also, like the podcast on Facebook. You'll also check us out on Twitter at PhDThePodcast. Our website is PhDThePodcast.com, which will also get you into themountaingeek.net, where you can find out more about all the fun things that I'm trying to do out in this universe as I work on being creative. Thanks again for listening. If you like what you've heard, please give us a review on iTunes. And until next time, keep shoveling.